There it is.
Okay. Thank you for attending this part of our presentation. You have heard all of the individual panelists and their discussions on the topic of the docs. And now we're going to be having an open discussion that is looking at specific areas where our points of research actually cross over, looking at masculinity, toxic masculinity, and the idea of the docs. So first, what I'd like to do is introduce all the panelists that you have heard already in their individual speeches and presentations, but they are all here today. And first is Dorian Alexander, who is a history professor from Seattle Central College. Hi, Dorian.
Hello.
Kyle Schuppe, who is a doctoral student in sociology at the University of Cincinnati.
Hello, everyone.
And Angus Henderson, who studies art history at Oklahoma State.
Hello.
Excellent. Thank you all for being here, and thank you again for participating in this panel. I am honored to be with three academics who know this topic so well. So let's start with the first question. The imagery of the docs as a sexual space has been popular in both general history and gay imagery. How do you think that affects how gay men approach the concept of sex? Dorian, why don't we start with you?
Well, yes, I was at my undergraduate was next to one of the largest Navy bases in the country. And it's not all it's cracked up to be, I'll start with that. But I think there's a popular depiction of the docks as sort of a Wild West saloon type space that isn't very reflective of the actual sort of the reality of the docks as a space. I think there's still probably that fascination with sailors or pirates that you can see expressed at, you know, you go to Pride or something, and certainly there's a plethora of sailor boy hats. As far as popular depictions, I'll bring it back to my topic, which was looking at the show Black Sails. And one of the things that I think was most unique about their depiction of queer sexuality was that the main character was very he was not a typical gay man. And their choice to make him involved with another man might have affected, pushed the general depiction of queer men at the docks in a more open direction, sort of like breaking down a lot of the popular stereotypes about what a gay sailor or gay pirate had to act like, look like, have sex like, etc. And we're talking about, I guess, the whole theme of the conferences has to do with toxic masculinity, breaking down some of the preconceived notions of what men have to be like when expressing themselves sexually. That was part of the show. And conversely, I would also say that a lot of standard aspects of toxic masculinity were also a part of that character, and they coincided oftentimes with the more positive depictions of tenderness, etc. So I don't know, very, very varied. I would be interested to see if any queer person would suggest that their actual like sex life has been directly affected by these popular depictions. But certainly I think the potential is there.
I think that's a very good point. And it's something that we definitely will talk about, this whole idea of how many people actually define their sexual identity through their actions on the docks? And if they do, what does that look like? Any other thoughts from anybody?
Well, if we're talking about... All right. If we're talking about depictions of toxic masculinity on the docks, or at least in regard to sailors, the Tijuana Bible that I spoke about with Donald Duck, I think, is a pretty good example. He's behaving exactly in the way one expects trade, especially like sailor trade, to be acting in the 40s in America, with a community large enough to support a sex worker population and a ferry sex worker population, which says something about the community in which he's interacting. And you can see a lot in the way he interacts with the other duck that he doesn't see him as an equal. And there's this kind of, I'm the man, I'm the top, toxicity to a lot of kind of transient interactions, at least historically.
Okay, I think we may have lost Angus.
Oh, no. Oh, for God's sake.
Oh, are you there?
Are you with me now?
Yes.
Oh, good. Did you hear any of that?
We heard most of it, I believe, so... Oh, no. This is where the power of editing comes in.
Oh, thank God. Ugh.
But yes, all good points. Kyle?
Yeah, so in thinking about the docks as a sexual space, for me, I'm really asking the question, right, for whom is it actually a sexual space? Because it requires the recognition of that space as a sexualized space where you can meet sexual partners or even have sex to occur. And I think Angus brings up an interesting point with this idea of that there's a sort of typology to the people. You have a masculinist sailor coming into the docks to meet up with effeminate men who may or may not be prostitutes. So I think there is a touch of what we might call toxic masculinity and a masculine hierarchy going on. But I'm also thinking about work that critiques that model, thinking about like Martin Levine's work on cruising, where you have this idea that it is a masculinist escapade, but one that is almost a parody of itself, right? So you have two men who are staring at each other and are too busy staring to actually commit to the act. Right, so I think, as Dorian said earlier, right, that there's this idea of sex that is so frequent and that occurs at the docks that doesn't actually happen, but the idea of it still persists.
That's an excellent point, and I think it branches into the next question that I'd have, and I want to start with Angus with this, because both you and Kyle did talk about this idea of different portrayals of masculinity where, well, yes, you talked about Donald Duck, but he was talking about the idea of this like tough sailor and the meek person seeking out. And let's investigate a little bit of these different portrayals of masculinity that we come out with as far as what goes on in the docks. Because Kyle, I'll just say that when I conceptualized in my head of what would be expected, it would be that the sailor would be putting on a front of looking like the tough alpha, but would play a more or less dominant role. So what about these portrayals of masculinity? Angus, let's start with you.
Well, you see a lot of very clear stereotypes, like in The Fleet's Inn, which Paul Cadmus, actually that was the first work to be in the New Deal's public arts project. But anyway, the sailors are these big, brawny brutes. They're kind of animalistic, and they're flirting with literally every other person in the scene. I think one of them is flirting with a tree. So there's this idea of masculinity almost so outgoing and overbearing that it becomes a parody of itself. And you see that parody sort of taken in and beloved by Tom of Finland, who just makes it worse and worse over the years until you get these big hulking men buying sailor costumes to wear to the bars. So I think the fact that you can take the idea of the docks with you just by wearing one of those little Dixie cup hats, that's really something to talk about. That's what they're called.
Excellent point. Kyle, I know you have something to say about this.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking that while the sailor uniform itself is unique to this setting, it's not anything particularly new in gay male communities. So I'm thinking about Peter Hinnan's argument about bears, gay bears doing a working class drag because they're all middle class men who are trying to aspire to this agrarian pastoral lifestyle through like flannel that is not their lives because they all work in tech. Right, that it's the embodiment of a masculinity that is in some ways inauthentic that they're authentically performing.
Fake it till you make it, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and how does that tie into what you're looking at, Dorian? Because I know there's a lot of research that shows that the life of the pirate was mostly boring. But there was this imagery of it being this exciting, cutthroat, highly aggressive, alpha, toxic masculinity when most individuals did not really have that opportunity.
Yeah, so if we want to talk about the history for a second, the popular action adventure depictions of them have one idea, but because the pirate communities were alternative spaces outside of mainstream society, it allowed for a lot of different expressions of gender and sexuality. It also allowed a lot of different people, like women, people of color, to express themselves and be a part of this society. And I think you're right. If you're talking about it being a little bit like boring, yeah, it wasn't as nasty as people presented as, but it was also more inclusive. And because they were all sort of grouped together in opposition to a society that was patriarchal, that was becoming very capitalistic, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of their identities and actions were informed in opposition to that. So it was a much safer space for, non-traditional expressions of masculinity.
Okay.
And speaking to the contradictions that I was talking about earlier, in sailors in general, I think it might be important to note the popular depictions of maritime culture because of its association with homosexuality. That in itself is an effeminizing force. So a lot of sailors nowadays have to sort of like feel compelled to fight back against that, either by engaging in performative conceptions of masculinity, like performing masculinity in very aggressive, toxic ways. That's something maybe to note as well.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. and that branch is, it's almost like these questions were programmed because it branches right into the next question, which, Kyle, this is all of your area because you were talking about the idea of in the Navy and in certain communities, and Dorian, you had mentioned this too, this idea that the docks were places where individuals were not allowed to go because there was this conceptualized idea that the docks were bad places and that active sailors in the Navy, for example, if they were going on the docks at night, then it's clear what they were doing. So it would be on the list of places that sailors should not be found. So talking about those imagery, that imagery and those ideas of the docks as a place of sexual taboo, what do you believe, Kyle, we'll start with you, what do you believe is the long-term effect on how gay men, straight men, and bisexual men perceive sex.
Yeah, I think it's almost a too big a question to answer in some ways, given that it's still ongoing. But when we think about the docks as a space that is both a place of sexual taboo, that is somewhere you're not supposed to go, that is somewhere where the Navy will surveil to try to locate you, but also a place of sexual possibility where it's, you can't have sex when on the ship now, you need to move off and go to the docks if you're trying to have any sort of sexual encounters with other men, that it kind of perpetuates the stigma of sex between men, that makes it private, or as private as possible, in a way that has to be secret, one-off sexual encounters that you can't establish any sort of long-term commitment through. So I think that's not necessarily distinct from the broader history of cruising that in city life, through whether that be parks, the tea rooms, et cetera. But I do think it points to that there is a sort of limitation of the sexual and romantic possibilities for men who have sex with men because of this sort of surveillance and punishment that occurs at this time.
Yes, and I think you're absolutely right, and that's where I can jump in with some of my research in talking about Bordeaux and the concept of symbolic capital, because I think that, and I believe you're right to branch it out to all public sex environments, that public sex environments in male existence represent a form of symbolic capital. Yes, there is a taboo, but, and I throw this out to everybody, isn't there something daring about saying that you actually met somebody or picked somebody up on the docks or in a public sex location? It shows your level of bravery, that there's almost a level of masculinity to that is granted unto you for doing something so significant.
If I can jump in, I think there's going to be a big difference in how you answer depending on the level of sophistication of the military that you're engaging with. Because certainly in my experience living next to the docks in sort of a real way, there's just no way that you could ever pick someone up in that way that you may have been able to in past ages. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to be sleeping with a sailor, there is still that level of maybe, oh, I'm sleeping with someone in the military. But that's mostly an allure, I think, that exists in the imagination of people who aren't near the docks. Because if you want to talk about the juxtaposition of things being a lot more boring in reality, that if you live near the docks, most of these men in the military are very boring.
Forget you. I was in for 15 years, but go ahead.
The majority of the soldiers, because they have to, because of that surveillance, I think, I'm sure you or Kyle were bringing that up, because of the surveillance that exists due to being in the military, you can only engage with them so far, and most of the sailors that are going to be looking for gay sex, they're just going to go to a gay bar, so it just sort of collapses those spaces in a way.
Okay.
The docks just becomes the gay bar. I like whoever mentions bringing the docks with them. I think that is something that, if we're talking about a modern version of the docks, I would almost say that it's an imaginative space that people carry with them rather than a real physical space, at least in America, just because of the amount of security around military installations and the surveillance inflicted upon modern sailors.
Okay. And guess, Kyle?
Well, I was going to say, I also think in a post Don't Ask, Don't Tell world, that the threat of no longer being expelled from the military means that there's more sexual freedom for sailors, so they don't need to be cruising at the docks to find sexual partners.
I think you're right, but one thing that I would argue is this. That means that the people that would be cruising, the sailors that would be cruising at the docks, could be those that are regressive and hold some level of either they haven't fully come out or haven't realized their sexual identity, or maybe they see the docks, something that you see in some early gay literature about individuals going to the docks, that it was perceived as some level of self-hate and that it was acting on a level of self-hate. So I'm wondering if, to use what Dorian was saying, and you to a degree, Kyle, that going to the docks can be performative for certain segments of the population.
Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a thing that a lot of the men that Tom of Finland drew between 1940 and about 1990, which is when he died, God bless that guy, but something they all have in common is a uniform. There are policemen, there are sailors, as you might imagine, there are army guys, there are cowboys, just all these ideas of these homosocial spaces that get brought into kind of the regular world. And so it becomes more the idea of this eroticized, romanticized homosocial space than it is about the person in the uniform.
Mm-hmm.
That can't be great for the sailors.
I wonder if there's something there about gleefully subverting the institutions that those uniforms represent. In a way, because you're talking about police and the military and all these things, they're usually institutions that are inflicting oppression upon queer communities. So sort of like having sex with this representative in a way, or symbolic presence of the institution, is also a way of, I don't know, subverting that oppression performatively.
Screwing the man back, you might say.
Yeah.
Right. And maybe a mix between what you're saying as far as like performative subversion and what Kyle was talking about before, which was performative class work, where individuals who are not working class are pretending to be in these roles that are very working class. And it allows for them to bring it all back to sociology, some level of impression management. But there's also an additional ability to simply step out of those roles when they don't want to be in them any longer.
Mm. Well, that's part of the appeal, isn't it? That's the whole point of a costume.
But then we talk about the toxicity of putting on someone's actual identity as a costume.
Yeah.
And how fair that is, but also how central that is to a component of how we understand gay life. I mean, we've mentioned Tom of Finland. We've talked about some of the historical ideas of gay men and gay relationships. We've talked about some of the more contemporary ideas of gay men. But this is a strong image that runs through how men interact with men. And this idea of public sex, and what it raises is this question about, what about men whose only sexual gratification and their only sexual release comes from public sex environments? What does that say about how they fashion their masculinity?
Are we talking like complete nothing but subversive? In the dark, in the park, that kind of relations?
Right, which are known in the field as PSEs, or public sex environments. Kyle, this is your baby.
Well, it's an interesting question. Well, I'm not sure there's anyone that just has sex in public. At least I've not run into anyone. But
I have.
Oh, okay.
Not in that way.
Oh.
Listen, we're not here to judge. But I'm not sure, right? Because, right, lacking in empirical evidence, I'm hesitant to speculate, because I think there's a variety of reasons that people do have sex in public, whether that's I'm a married straight man with wife and kids at home, so I have to have this sex that I desire outside of my house, this is where I have it, to a screwing the man perspective, wow, having sex in public is really hot. So I'm not sure there is or can be one totalizing narrative for how that works.
That could be the same encounter.
It could be.
It very much could be. And I mean, we can talk from a perspective of public health that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were so concerned about this some 20, 25 years ago that they commissioned the creation of an HIV plan to approach men and do HIV prevention work in public sex environments, like how to go to docks and how to go to parks and talk to men about this. So the implication was that there was riskier behavior happening in public sex environments. And it's riskier behavior with a sense of implied negotiation, which in itself is its own toxicity.
I wonder, I don't think there's, and maybe Kyle, you can answer this, but when you were talking about performing class, is that also involved in public sex? Because I'm thinking, historically speaking, right, a lot of the reasons that you would have sex in a public park or at the docks, et cetera, is because most working class people didn't have private rooms, you know, so you couldn't exactly invite a hookup back, or you're living in such close quarters with people that, you know, you wouldn't be able to have gay sex in particular without them finding out. And there's sort of an element of historical roguishness or risk there as well. Does that play any part of public sex?
So housing access is an important thing, right? Like, so is there, one, a place where you can have sex that is your place, right? Sort of the private space for sex. But then also, is that place functional to a sexual encounter, right? Is no one else there? That's a part of it. And then on the flip side, there's the middle to upper class men who kind of do some management when they're cruising in public. To be like, right, so if you're wearing a business suit in the middle of a park, that's suspicious. You have to manage that to look like you're someone who's supposed to be there and can be there for a while and not be picked up by the police for engaging or soliciting public sex.
Okay. That just reminds me of a situation which really did happen to me, where me and a friend, we were visiting Rome, actually. Mm-hmm. And me and a friend kind of wandered into a park. We were just sightseeing, and we wandered into a park, and literally everyone in the park was either in a naval uniform or a business suit. And I looked at my friend and I was like, this is a public sex environment. And he said, no, it's not. And I said, yes, it is. And we got out of there, and he checked on his phone and he said, oh yes, the phone says it's the most known public sex environment in all of Rome. I'm like, where else are you going to find literally a space with 50 men who are either in business suits or naval uniforms? It was just amazing.
Well, I mean, props to them. Like, not even trying to be inconspicuous.
Well, yeah, that's
like,
that's
get it, girl.
Well, so I'm going to ask the final question. It's not a question, but it's a statement, and I'm just going to ask each of you to react to it. And the statement is this: the docs reinforce a toxicity to masculinity by hiding and masking sexuality. Angus, we're going to start with you. React to that.
Well, I think you could say the same thing about any public sex environment, and shame can, I'm sorry, repeat the question.
The docks reinforce a toxicity to masculinity by hiding and masking sexuality.
Well, the docs are going to reinforce it so long as the people in charge of the docs are reinforcing it. And those people are in charge of all the other public sex spaces, too. So I feel like perhaps they do, but I also feel like it's kind of a reductive statement.
Okay. Dorian.
I'm going to go back to this because I really, really like the carrying the docs with you thing. And I think it's great that this imagery that we have of the docks as an inherently sexual place is used in a lot of sex positive ways. You know, you show up to a place wearing a cute little sailor's outfit and it's, you know, you're being inviting, you're engaging in sexuality, often in a public way. So I would actually push back against that statement. I think that the docks as a performative space or the docks as a cultural fixation can now be, I think it's not as toxic as we might presume.
Okay. Kyle?
I like his better. Say I said that.
Yeah, there's not that much magic in terms of editing. No,
just edit it, it's fine.
Kyle?
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting idea because right, the docs exist to enable a certain form of queer sexuality to occur, but because it enables this, it means it's hidden from public life. So the toxicity that I see in masculinity is not involved with any of the practitioners of sex on the docks, but rather, right, the masculinity that is heteronormative, that is white, that is perpetuated by the military, that pushes queer sexuality to the margins where it needs to be on the outside of society, on the docks. So the docks do reinforce the toxic masculinity, but it's the toxic masculinity that makes the docks a place where sex has to happen because it can't happen anywhere else.
Okay. And my take on it is in its own way similar to Kyle's. I'm using Bourdieu again as a lens, and his idea of habitus, which is this, these bodily dispositions, the way that in which we are expected to react to certain things that happen in the social world. And I think one of the dispositions that occurs through both public sex environments and the docs specifically is this idea that sex is supposed to be this kind of semi-silent visual game where there is no discussion, that discussion and a lot of getting to know is in itself not masculine. And to be hyper-masculine, one simply looks at someone, decides they want them, and then they go at it. And that in and of itself is toxic because that's not how it works. That's not how any of this works. And if people take that out of the docks, and one of the things, having worked, in addition to my work in sociology, but having worked in public health, specifically in HIV prevention, is that when that lack of negotiation is taken outside of the public sex environment, it can become dangerous because of the information that is not shared between individuals. The idea that we feminize discourse in any form prior to sex or post-sex means that it is limiting the growth that is possible for the idea of masculinity overall and the idea of sex being something more than just the physical act, which is something in the sexual revolution we've been talking about for 50 years. So I can see where the statement has some merit, but I agree with many of you in that there is a level of naivete to the statement. Any final thoughts from anyone?
So I've been thinking throughout the conversation about the sort of contradictory nature of the military. So you have a body that is in many ways obsessed with a certain form of masculinity and masculine embodiment that is white heterosexual and able to do the work of the state. But following John D'Amelio's argument in Capitalism and Gay Identity, also enabled gay communities to come into being, because now men who were interested in having sex with men are no longer connected to the sort of pastoral agrarian life where it's like we have to raise a farm and we have to raise a family, and that now that there's this, whether there's a war, that we can now exist and organize our lives around desire for other men. So I'm thinking that there's just this fascinating contradiction that exists in how the military, again, prohibits yet enables certain forms of queer desire and queer identity to occur.
Okay. Dorian, any final thoughts?
No, I concur with that. Like the military, and if you look at like large bumps in almost like social progress or the loosening of social mores, it often follows massive military movements because the anonymity, and there's just this sort of, especially larger wars like the world wars, there was this almost cultural consensus that, well, you know, this might be it, so you should do everything that you wanted.
Okay.
And
oh.
Then, you know, ended up backlash fairly quickly. Usually a backlash forms fairly quickly, but it definitely does allow a lot of opportunity.
Oh my God.
Okay, there's going to be a lot of editing there. And Angus.
I'm going to agree with all three. Well, you haven't really said anything yet, but
Actually, I did.
I just didn't hear it. My connection is terrible. The storm is coming in. Sorry. But no, this has been a really cool conversation, and I appreciate that I was there for it.
Okay, excellent. Thank you to all of you for participating in this. This has been extremely enlightening. And these are the types of conversations that can happen in an academic frame that I think that others will definitely find interesting. So thank you all for participating.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for organizing.
And for those who are listening to this, you will have the ability to ask us questions if you have any additional questions. So our information, our contact information is going to be available, and please feel free to contact us if you do have any questions or comments about the things that we have been discussing in this presentation. And we would like to thank the organizers of this conference for the opportunity to have this unique experience. And thanks again.